conference room, so I will go get it. But you all start without me. I'll catch up shortly. All right. Eileen Hirsch, Assistant Public Defender.
Thank you. I represent the defendant, Eric Henderson, in this case. This case is about the judiciary's role in enforcing the requirement that police knock and announce their presence before they search a home. Traditionally, the judiciary reviews government searches of citizens at two points. First, before the search takes place, when police seek a warrant authorizing the search, and second, after a search, if criminal charges are filed and a suppression motion is filed. The state's position in this case would effectively end meaningful judicial review of no-knock authority at both the warrant application stage and the suppression hearing stage. First, it would make the warrant decision meaningless by allowing police to ignore the magistrate's decision when they request a no-knock authority and then obtain a later de novo review of their no-knock entry. Second, it would end judicial review of no-knock entries altogether by creating an exception to the exclusionary rule that is so large that it would, in one swift move, gut the Constitution's regulation of no-knock searches. In this case, the police broke down the door to Eric Henderson's home in order to search for illegal drugs. Just a few hours earlier, they had requested a no-knock search warrant. The judge had issued the warrant. He found probable cause to search Mr. Henderson's home, but the judge had not given the police the no-knock authority. No new exigent circumstances arose, but police entered the home without knocking anyway. The first question in the case then...
The judge did not refuse to issue it. He just didn't do anything, didn't he?
The record in the case is that the police requested, the application shows a request for no-knock authority, clearly insufficient allegations for it, and the warrant that was issued does not include the no-knock authority. There was no discussion or record made about the reasons that the judge, that those two events happened.
Mr. Hirsch, is there any indication here as to whether or not the judge had any discussion with the officer, whether the officer came in with the affidavit in hand, or just what the circumstances were?
There was nothing in the record about those circumstances. There's no proof of what happened other than the application and the warrant that was actually came out.
There were several officers involved in this, right? I mean, in the testimony during the suppression hearing, as I recall, Is it your position that at the time you seek a warrant, that all information from all officers has to be known or at least made known at that time?
If such information is necessary for the no-knock authority, in the same way that it is when police come in asking for a search warrant, the underlying search warrant, that the police need to bring in the authority that they have to show they have probable cause. And so the same information would be necessary regarding the no-knock authority, that the police would bring in the information they have supporting their belief that they have reasons to go into that home without knocking.
Suppose you had an affidavit and it had limited information, and that but much more information was available at that very time, but they got a warrant with this limited information. Now there's a motion to suppress the evidence. And can they bring in more evidence that at the time of the warrant there was more evidence available, or you're limited to that which was presented at that time?
We're proposing that the rule be exactly what it is for the underlying search warrant, that the court gives deference to the magistrate's decision and that the record be limited to that was before the magistrate. And so I think the answer to your specific question, if I understood it correctly, is no additional evidence would come in unless there were exigent circumstances. This doesn't apply if new exigent circumstances come
up. Then you wouldn't need a warrant, probably.
Probably not. I mean, the Cleveland versus State decision recognizes the exigent circumstances may change to take away the authority, but in the usual situation, exigent circumstances would come up at the time of the search, and clearly nobody's going to require that the magistrate review that before they go in. But otherwise, what we're proposing is that in Cleveland versus State and Williams versus State, this court has twice recommended that police, when they believe they have authority for no-knock entrance, when they go for their warrant, that they should bring that information to the magistrate. And what we're proposing is that if the court, and we believe that's the right policy under the Constitution, that all of the constitutional principles support that policy. And if police are going to do it, that decision should be meaningful. That otherwise, there's no reason for the police to come in for it, and there's no reason for the magistrate to make a decision. If it is a completely de novo review later on in the process, the magistrate's decision is meaningless. It's not a useful or meaningful exercise for the judiciary to go through.
Would your rule apply regardless of whether the officers asked for a no-knock warrant or not?
I think that it's not necessary to the decision of this case, of our case, our facts for Mr. Henderson, for that to be the general rule. My suggestion is, based on the constitutional principles, that the rule should be, as set forward in Cleveland and Williams, that if they have what they believe is sufficient facts to justify a no-knock entry, they, and I would change the word from should to must, bring that to the magistrate. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask about a policy which if there are several officers involved, and apparently, as I read this, at least from what I know from the record, there were here, they have to pool their information, and everything you're saying that the policy should be or must be, not should be, but must be that all of this information has to be given to the judge at that time. So if they omit something that was known to one of them, that then they cannot, then it's, well, basically the suppression would be upheld.
If the judge didn't grant the warrant, you're making the assumption in that one that the judge didn't grant the warrant, that the officers come in and say, we believe we have grounds for no-knock authority, and the judge says, no, you don't. We don't have reasonable grounds here. Then we would say that what was available to police and what they knew at that time cannot be later brought in as a de novo justification for the warrant. So I guess if you're saying, assuming the judge didn't grant the warrant. Now, in this case, I think truly, in this case, Officer Retzky was the major officer. He was the one who got the warrant. He was the one who testified about the information. He was assisted in the search. But I think this case is fairly typical that there's a police officer who's in charge of this whole operation and who knows all of the information, virtually all of the information. And so I think that yes, they are responsible for everything the police officer knows.
Well, what if a police officer believes that he or she doesn't have sufficient to get a no-knock, so doesn't bother to ask for it?
That would be fine.
Well, but then at the scene, but has a lot of information, right, but doesn't believe that all these little facts add up to a reasonable suspicion.
And so they don't seek a warrant. I don't think we can have a rule or a policy where police have to come and ask for no-knock authority when they don't have, they don't believe they have reason to ask for no-knock authority.
Well, then,
so then their testimony at the suppression hearing is, I did not ask for no-knock authority because I did not believe I had reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then this happened. But it precludes them from not asking for no-knock authority. So they want to enter no-knock, but they don't ask.
Well,
but nothing new happens.
What concerns me, Ms. Hirsch, is that you may be creating a disincentive for the police to request a no-knock. They just say, hey, why should we take a chance on requesting a no-knock if, in fact, the judge turns us down, and then, later on we have enough. Why not just every time say, well, we probably don't have enough, and then get there and find something?
But for two reasons. It's the same incentives there are in search warrant, the underlying search warrant application. The incentive for police to ask for a search warrant is provided by the courts, which is deference to the magistrate's authority. So if they get it, they know this 99% of the time is going to be a valid search and their evidence is going to be admitted. So that works in favor of it. The other thing is that if nothing new happens, as it often won't, they won't be able to go back then and say, oh, nothing new happened, but we didn't ask for the authority. We can't make the assumption that in every single search incident that something is going to happen at the door which affects the authority of the police to enter without knocking. In this case, nothing happened. They got their warrant, nothing, there's not one new exigent circumstance. And so in this situation, if they hadn't asked the judge, and if our rule were the case, they had not asked the judge, they wouldn't have the authority to enter no knock because they have no new exigent circumstances. So the incentive would be to ask whenever they thought they might have one. Now let me just give you the flip side of this, though, which is if we have a policy that police should go to the magistrate, are we willing to have the current state of the law, if the state's position, which is accepted, is we say, police, you should go to the magistrate, you should ask for a warrant, but if the magistrate doesn't grant you one, that's okay, you can go ahead and do your search anyway, your no-knock entry anyway. And if the magistrate does grant you no-knock authority, you still have to prove it again at the suppression hearing in this case. And it's a de novo review, the magistrate's decision is never entitled to deference. It makes that point where they go, currently under our current law where we're saying they should go, it makes that point where they go to the magistrate an absolutely meaningless exercise for the police officers. I think the incentive is not to do it now because there's no point in it.
It was interesting in this case that it's the same person.
The judge?
Well, it was
or the officer?
The person that issued the warrant is the same person that had the suppression hearing. That doesn't often happen, but it did in this one, I noted that.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, and he apparently didn't remember what happened at the time he issued the warrant. By the time they got to the suppression hearing, it was several months later. It is unusual, I think, in that way.
Now, Richards, as I've gone back and read it, they did ask for a no-knock.
That's correct.
And they didn't get it. But I don't see that was made into a big issue.
Well, what happened in Richards was that something happened at the door. They said that it was brought out. The magistrate did not give them a warrant. But what happened at the door is that Richard saw a police officer. The exigencies arose. The suspicion happened at the door when they began their search. When they knocked, actually, they followed the magistrate's decision, knocked at the door, and then something happened which made them push open the door. And the Supreme Court recognized, as it often does in Cleveland and Williams, that there could be exigent circumstances arising. But I think the fact that there are sometimes...
Those circumstances that occurred after the warrant?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yes. I think the fact that that exigent circumstances arise in some cases involving no-knock entries does not suggest that we should have a general category of exception saying that you never have to go to a magistrate for a prior approval of a requested no-knock entry.
Do you think it's constitutionally required that you have to ask for no-knock? Maybe that's what you're arguing. No-knock if you got the evidence. And what's your support for that?
I have two answers to that. I do think it's constitutionally required, and my support for it is the basic general, the basic principles of the Fourth Amendment. The history of the Fourth Amendment is that the framers of the Constitution were very concerned about the king's soldiers entering their homes, and they specifically included a protection against that, and they specifically placed the judiciary as the protection between the citizens and the police. They were not willing to leave the decisions about whether a search was reasonable to the law enforcement arm of the government. And they specifically have, over and over in our constitutional history, the position of the judiciary to protect citizens from unreasonable entries into their home is very clear. Now we have the Wilson versus Arkansas saying that the manner of entering your home is part of the reasonableness inquiry under the Constitution.
They didn't say anything, as I read Arkansas v. Wilson. They didn't say anything about having to get that into a warrant.
That issue wasn't raised.
Right.
I think that may be the case where there's a footnote saying they're not reaching that issue. I'm not quite 100% sure on that. But if that's part of our reasonableness requirement in the Fourth Amendment, this protection of the judiciary is also part of the reasonable of the Fourth Amendment, and I think those two intersect. Now, the constitutional analysis that is done when the question arises, is it necessary to get a warrant or not, weighs the state's interest, the government's interest, in being able, not having a huge burden of proving things is very difficult, slowing the police down, interfering with their work, versus the citizens' interest in privacy. And when you weigh those factors in this case, you have values that are at the very core of the First Amendment. You have, or the Fourth Amendment. You have police breaking down the door of your home. These are essential core privacy rights. The burden on the police is minimal. The burden on the police is that if they believe they have reasonable grounds to enter no knock at the time they bring probable cause to the magistrate, they have to set those reasons before the magistrate, just as they do their reasons for believing they have probable cause to search at all, and ask for the approval to do so. And so that weighing under the constitutional analysis weighs in favor of a constitutional requirement that when they have the grounds, they must bring it to the magistrate.
Is it just the police that come to the magistrate? Is that the minds that we're looking into? What if they don't know that there's, you know, four prior convictions, but it's certainly knowledge available to them, and maybe another police officer knows that, but he's not in the judge's chambers?
Again, I think that the rules that apply to the search warrant would apply to the underlying search warrant would apply to the no-knock authority in that case. And so it would be the same kind of burden that police already deal with in terms of what information they need to know going into this.
So if, I don't quite understand what the answer to my question is.
Okay.
Yes or no? In other words, if a person has a record mm-hmm. that evinces dangerousness, but it's not revealed to the judge because the officer does not know that.
Okay. Let me tell you why I'm not giving you a definitive answer to that, because I don't know for sure what the answer to that is in the search warrant context. So if that officer, maybe you can help me, maybe if that officer came to the judge and said, I have probable cause to believe that this person has illegal drugs in their home or whatever, and here's the information I have, is that, if he doesn't know other information available to other police, where does that fit in? I don't know the answer to that. So whatever that answer is my that's why I'm not answering the question. But I assume it's answered in the search warrant context. It's just not something that's within my individual knowledge at this point.
Counsel, in your introductory comments, you kind of paraphrased, I think, some of the language from the Whiteley decision, essentially saying a contrary rule would, of course, render the Fourth right. Amendment meaningless. That's in a footnote. Whiteley is a probable cause case,
correct.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
Why can you rely on this footnote in Whiteley as support for your premise?
Well, I guess I would say, first of all, my comment about how this would take away meaningful judicial review goes largely to the exclusionary rule, too, which is partly goes to the exclusionary rule, and we can talk about that. It's not based simply on Whiteley, that general introductory comment. But Whiteley is, I was just checking my brief, I believe that Whiteley is, first of all, it's based on all the constitutional principles about giving deference, about forcing decisions to be made at the point that the magistrate reviews a search warrant, that's the protection of citizens from unreasonable searches. And so it's part and parcel of the deference that's given to that magistrate's review that the reviewing court is also limited to the record that's in front of the magistrate. The other thing, I'm checking my brief, and I'm not 100% sure of this, I think that Whiteley is, the Fave also says, this is conclusion is self-evident, and there's Higginbotham, and there's other cases about that. So it's not just the footnote in Whiteley. I think it's a well-established principle of the law. The other, Justice Abramson asked about whether I believe this is constitutional requirement. The other point here is, this court has twice made this decision in Williams and Cleveland. It seems to me that in order to make the court's suggestion or the recommendation that police do so, that police go to the magistrate, a meaningful recommendation. The other way the court could go on this is to say this is a matter of judicial administration, that we're not going to recommend that police go to magistrates and we're not going to ask magistrates to make decisions if that's not a meaningful review. And it could, as a matter of, this court could, as a matter of judicial administration, I believe, make that a requirement under our rules.
Well, it's footnote 7 in Richards that
okay.
I think is the
all right. Thank
what
you.
We're talking about.
Okay.
And it says, a number of states give magistrate judges the authority to issue no-knock warrants if the officers demonstrate ahead of time a reasonable suspicion that entry without prior announcement will be appropriate in the particular context. So they don't seem to say that there you have to have a magistrate. Okay, then they
That's
give some
correct.
Citations.
That's correct.
Then it goes on to say, the practice of allowing magistrates to issue no-knock warrants seems entirely reasonable.
That's correct.
When sufficient cause to do so can be demonstrated ahead of time. But as the facts in this case demonstrate, a magistrate's decision not to authorize a no-knock entry should not be interpreted to remove the officer's authority to exercise independent judgment concerning the wisdom of a no-knock entry at the time the warrant is being issued, it being executed.
Right.
So you read that to say only if circumstances afterwards occur.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct.
Now,
go ahead. I'm
you've spent a lot of your time, and properly so, on the constitutional or judicial administration issue. It seems to me your brief also takes the position that they had no, the law enforcement officers did not have adequate grounds to go in without a knock, either at the time of the warrant or at the time they entered the building.
That's correct.
So maybe...
And let me tell you, I'm in a dilemma here because there's also the issue of the exception of the exclusionary rule.
Yes.
But I think, without spending too much time on the facts, I ask you to take a look. That is our argument exactly. Even if you look at every fact the police presented at any point in this case, when you look at the specific facts they had about Mr. Henderson, they do not support a reasonable suspicion that he was either likely to destroy evidence or to cause danger to the police. I believe those facts really lead to the opposite inference. And I ask you to look at the police officer's testimony in the suppression hearing and see how many times they use the phrase, Mr. Henderson and his associates, or Mr. Henderson and his group of people. And I suggest to you that every time they do that, they are simply substituting those words for the words that have been found not to be justification for no-knock searches, which is all drug dealers do X.
Destroy their evidence and have guns.
So, right. And without explaining exactly who these associates or this group of people are, the police officers over and over and over say, Mr. Henderson and his group of people are smart when it comes to drug dealing and don't want to get caught. Mr. Henderson and his group of people were at this bar called Bruisers, and it was a combative atmosphere. They make up, there's this person named Larry Moore, who, there's no proof that Mr. Henderson even knew Larry Moore, first of all.
But a friend of his, obviously, knew Moore.
No, the only association they show between Mr. Henderson and Mr. Moore is that they were both targets of a police investigation. What does that tell you? It tells you they're both drug dealers. It doesn't tell you they knew each other. And even if they did, how do you impute the fact that one person who maybe is a, I have a friend who owns a gun, does that mean that I own a gun? Or the fact that she used to own a gun mean that I own a gun? What the testimony at the hearing consists of really is basically exchanging a few words to make the same generalizations about drug dealers. I didn't want to talk about the exclusionary rule today, but I do need to since it's been raised in this court, unless you don't want me to go into that at all.
No, I think you better go into it.
Okay. A quick argument on the exclusionary rule. The state's exception to the exclusionary rule goes way beyond the good faith arguments that have been made to this court recently. The state's exception to the exclusionary rule in this case is what they call the independent source doctrine. And in order to get to an independent source doctrine, they take this search of Mr. Henderson's apartment and they make an artificial division of this search in a way that's difficult for me to even describe. In order to come to the independent source doctrine, they argue that there were two searches here. One was the legal search done pursuant to a search warrant. And that's where the evidence at issue was recovered. And then there was this other illegal search initiated by a no-knock entry, but evidently no evidence came out of that one. And so they take one search and divide it in two and try to impose the independent source doctrine on that. If you go back to the independent source doctrine cases, the one leading case really is Segura versus United States, where there were very clearly two searches. It was a case where a man was arrested outside his home. The police went in and did an illegal search of his home, evidently realized it was illegal, and then went back to a magistrate and obtained a search warrant using only information they knew before they went into the home. That search warrant was completely untainted by the illegal search, and they went in and did another search and got the evidence at issue in the case. That I understand. That's an independent source. The Jones case also cited, I think it's a Seventh Circuit case, police officers came in the back door, legally arrested Mr. Jones, and another team of officers came in the front door illegally. That's an independent source. In this case, we have one search, and that search was illegal. And I don't believe that this falls under the independent source doctrine.
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch.
Could I ask one question?
Yes, I'm sorry. Justice Prosser.
In 1994, when there was a search warrant for Mr. Henderson's residence, were the police seeking marijuana or cocaine or both?
I don't know for sure the answer to that, and I'm not sure that it's in the record. I'm almost 100% sure that they found marijuana, but I don't know whether there was a cocaine expectation in that.
But in this case, they were seeking both marijuana and cocaine.
Correct, and they found marijuana again.
That's right. But cocaine had been in the residence the day before. That was the basis for the search warrant, was it not?
That's correct. That was the confidential informant's information to them. That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. Before I call on Diane Welsh, I'm going to introduce some people in the audience. We want to welcome the students from Baraboo High School. Would they stand? Thank you for coming. We hope you find this educational and enjoyable. We have philosophy and rhetoric students from UW-Baraboo who are grading the court and counsel. So the UW-Baraboo students, please stand. For coming. And are you the faculty advisor? Thank you for coming and bringing them. And we have the clerk of circuit courts and members of her staff. Would you please rise? Thank you. You've been very loyal, dedicated viewers of the court today, and thank you. And thank the Office of Clerk of the Circuit Court. That office is very important to the operation of the Circuit Court in this county. Ms. Walsh, we gave you some time to think. More time to think. Assistant Attorney General Diane Walsh. Ms. Welsh.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Diane Walsh representing the plaintiff respondent, the state of Wisconsin. I'm here to ask you to reject Mr. Henderson's invitation to create a new constitutional rule requiring prior judicial authorization for no-knock entry and affirm the judgment of conviction entered below. In response to some points made by Attorney Hirsch, I want to clarify that the officers in this case did apply for a no-knock warrant authorization when they sought the warrant, and it was before Judge Finn. And it's clear from the transcript of the suppression hearing that all parties thought that it was a no-knock warrant that was issued. It wasn't the case. I mean, they had just failed to indicate it on the face of the warrant. It seems.
Have the parties stipulated to that?
I'm sorry?
Have the parties stipulated to that? I was reading another case that's pretty much on all fours with this case, and in that case, the parties stipulated to
There's no discussion. There's no questioning by the defense attorney or the, you know, indicating that they didn't believe they had a no-knock warrant.
I mean, so. It is One way of approaching it is to say, based on reading the transcript, mm-hmm. it's a reasonable inference that all parties thought. Mm-hmm. There's another approach saying the parties stipulated to it.
Right.
And as I gather the record, the parties haven't stipulated.
They haven't stipulated, and it's based on a reading of the transcript.
Do we have a good faith issue here?
We haven't raised it, but I think there might be. And I would point out that if you want to encourage officers to follow the better practice of seeking no-knock authorization, applying the good faith exception would encourage that practice. So as opposed to the policy that the defense counsel argues, you know, the state can envision that a way of ensuring compliance with that better practice would be application of the good faith.
What did Judge Finn say at the suppression hearing that would lead you to conclude that he believed that he had issued a no-knock warrant?
I think it was his evaluation of what was presented in the application and a discussion that didn't warrant the no-knock authorization, but that, you know, by independently reviewing what the officers knew, did. So I guess he doesn't ever discuss that he didn't grant the no-knock warrant. It's implicit in how he evaluates what was presented in the affidavit and then the additional facts known to the officers.
Opposing counsel takes issue with the fact that we should retain you argue that we should retain the reasonable suspicions sufficient, and you say that there is reasonable suspicion here, and that should be maintained. But it would seem from a policy argument, and she's talking, opposing counsel is mentioning from judicial administration, that this court should come down and say this is the way it should be done, and if it's not done that way, then the suppression would be upheld. And what I'm asking here is that isn't this what we should do? I mean, this seems to be, we have the Richards case, of course, which would perhaps allow this, but we have other cases that say, well, we should have all the information up front to the magistrate, and that's the better public policy.
Merely because something is better public policy does not mean that it finds support in the Constitution. I think this court has an obligation to interpret the Fourth Amendment consistent with the United States Supreme Court. I think the language of Dahlia versus United States and Richards versus Wisconsin supports the proposition that police do not need to get prior judicial authorization for permission to execute the warrant in a specific manner. I think a holding to the contrary can't be supported or can't coexist with the expressed language of U.S. Supreme Court decisions.
Counsel, are you familiar with the Espinoza case that came out this summer from the Eastern District on no-knock warrants?
Yes, as I was preparing for this argument, I came across that case.
And that case, it's citing some cases. Let me confess, I have not read these cases that it's citing, but it says, in Buckley, the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit observed that, quote, in the normal execution of a search warrant, the Fourth Amendment requires officers to knock and announce their presence before entering a dwelling. That seems, goes on to say, in Wilson versus Arkansas, the Supreme Court held the Fourth Amendment incorporates the common law requirement that police officers entering a dwelling must knock on the door and announce their identity and purpose before attempting a forcible entry. Do you disagree with either of those premises of law?
No, I don't disagree with those premises, but I do disagree with their citations to other Seventh Circuit decisions. Specifically, they cite to United States versus Jones and United States versus Stefanik, which I do not believe stand for the principles for which they use them.
Do the cases, the Buckley case and the Wilson case that I read, do you agree with those premises as I read them from the Buckley and Wilson case?
that the knocking and announcing is part of the reasonableness requirement of the Fourth Amendment. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Does the constitutional preference for a magistrate's prior authorization of a search apply to no-knock entries?
No. I think what's important is who gets deference when. The determination that for a search warrant, it's the magistrate is assigned the task of deciding whether or not there's probable cause to issue a search warrant. In determining the manner of execution, we defer to the officers who are executing the search warrant to determine the appropriate manner of entry. And that's a search that gets judicial review after the fact. So the reasonableness of the search is evaluated after the fact by the judiciary. And it is a meaningful review. And I think Richards versus Wisconsin ensures that it's a meaningful review by not applying a blanket rule. So while we think review is appropriate, I think we have to look at the functions and the differing functions of the magistrate in determining whether or not there's probable cause, and then deferring to the executing officers to determine whether their suspicion is reasonable.
I think I'm lost. I might be perplexed. I haven't decided.
Or both.
If you agree with the premise that Buckley, if you agree with the premise that the normal execution of search warrants, the Fourth Amendment requires officers to knock and announce, and in Wilson, the Supreme Court held that the Fourth Amendment incorporates the common law requirement that police officers entering a dwelling must knock on the door and announce their identity. And if these are, and I always think of the Constitution as hallowed, you know, if these are sacrosanct, if these are hallowed principles, then by not requiring any review of, meaningful review of judicial discretion, it seems like these hallowed and sacrosanct principles ring hollow.
I think the sacrosanct principle of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness, and I believe there is a meaningful review of the reasonableness of the search after the fact.
Well, I agree that the Fourth Amendment talks about reasonableness, but you've got the Fourth Amendment encrusted with a couple of hundred years of cases. And those cases say if you're going to enter a home, you've got to have a warrant, mm-hmm. unless you have exigent circumstances, and none of the exceptions are here. So the rule under the Fourth Amendment for reasonableness is warrant, right? Mm-hmm. So, says defense counsel, and following Justice Bradley's line of reasoning, if you've got to have a search warrant to enter the home, and no-knock is part of the Fourth Amendment, that is, you must knock and announce as part of the Fourth Amendment, then why don't you say, put the two together, and say you've got to have a warrant that says no-knock if you're going to enter no-knock. Or you can have a warrant which is silent about knock and announce, but then you have to have information between the warrant and getting to the house or at the house that gives you the right to knock, gives you the right to not knock. And all the, and I think that's what the gist of Justice Bradley's questions are. If you look at those two sentences, which I agree are correct law, and mm-hmm. so do you, and I'm sure the defense counsel would agree, then doesn't it follow that you need to have no-knock authority in the warrant because you need a warrant to get into the house? And that's the shorthand of defense's position mm-hmm. here.
Right.
What's your response to that?
But no, because there are different standards for evaluating what's necessary to get into the house and whether or not to knock and announce. And the discretion for deciding those things are placed with two different entities. You know, the the decision for whether or not there's probable cause rests with the neutral and detached magistrate. The decision for what manner of execution is most appropriate is within the discretion of the executing officers.
Ms. Welsh, that's what you say, but why do you have to say that? You can say that it's initially with the magistrate. What's your authority for saying it's not with the magistrate?
Dahlia versus United States and cases that follow. You know, this court and the Wisconsin Court of Appeals has cited Dahlia for that proposition.
Which is?
That the decision of how best to execute a warrant is left to the discretion of the officers executing.
As long as it's reasonable. And that's
right, within the confines of reasonableness.
And yet I come across a case, a district case, I don't know if you're familiar with it, United States versus Dupras, D-U-P-R-A-S. You know how exciting it is to find a case that's on at least, if not all fours, all three and nine-tenths? That's this case. And there, in fact, there was, everyone thought they went to the judge and were getting a no-knock, and the parties stipulated, this is the case I was referring to, the parties stipulated that they all thought they were going to get a no-knock. But lo and behold, the warrant that came out from the judge's signature didn't have anything about it, much like we have here today. Well, they got the information. It was a drug deal, of course, and they got the information for the application on St. Patrick's Day. And no cause and effect. It was on March 17th. And they went the application. They thought they were getting a no-knock. Nothing was addressed. They stipulate they're going to get a no-knock, that they wanted one. They didn't get one. Then you have on March 18th, the SWAT team gets together, and they look at the warrant. They say, doesn't say anything about a knock or no-knock, but we're going to do our independent risk analysis. No new exigent circumstances, just like in our case here, no new exigent circumstances. And the court said a couple of interesting things. It said, it concluded, number one, that the police have only the authority expressly granted in the warrant. Similarly here, because the warrant did not authorize a no-knock, the police were not entitled to execute a no-knock search absent some exigent circumstances that took place, they said, at the scene. None did, so the motion to suppress must be granted, and that's the conclusion of the case. If you're not familiar with it, it may be difficult for you to distinguish it. It just seems to me to be so much this case that it's hard for me to draw back from it and come around it. Can you help me? Can you help me see your view? Because this case is right on point.
And it's hard not having read the case. And I think what's important is to keep the remedy in mind. And so in that case,
it was a motion to suppress.
And in the present case, if you're really looking at suppressing reliable, relevant evidence, even though the search was reasonable in fact, merely because we apply a legal fiction and don't include facts that were known to the officers at the time of entry, because we withhold those facts from the reviewing court at a suppression motion, we will be suppressing evidence when there's been in fact no constitutional violation. And I think that's what the risk is, that it's fine. It is arguably a better practice for the police to get prior judicial authorization. There may be sound policy reasons to tell police to do that. But whether that equates with a constitutional requirement that results in a remedy which includes withholding relevant and reliable information from the reviewing court, I don't think the Constitution provides for that. And I don't think that is sound public policy. I think when you balance out the countervailing interests for the judiciary seeking to obtain an accurate result in a criminal trial, where evidence is artificially withheld, even when there is no violation of the Fourth Amendment, I think that's that's not in society's best interest, and I think we should be hesitant to go there.
And do you think that's what the Court of Appeals was saying in its certification to us? It cited Cleveland, and looking at page 4 of the certification, and Williams, and it said whether the directives offered in Williams and Cleveland should be elevated to a constitutional rule comparable to that for probable cause challenges is a matter for the Supreme Court to decide. One way of interpreting that is the Court of Appeals acknowledges that it's the way to go, that is, to get the magistrate authority, but whether or not it should really be a constitutional rule is another issue. Is that what you're saying? Or is
right. That, you know, it's good to, you know, if this court wants to provide further advice mm-hmm. to officers, you know, who are familiar with constitutional law, that this is a good thing to do, keep doing it. And in this case, they did try to get a warrant. This isn't a case where they did not try to obtain a warrant.
I know that the defendant, I think maybe it's page 1 of the brief. The defendant says the certification suggests that the Wisconsin law already indicates that officers should present information justifying a no-knock entry to the magistrate, but leaving it to the Supreme Court to determine whether that directive should be elevated to a constitutional rule. Do you agree with that assertion in the defendant's brief?
I think it's one way to read the certification. I think there is a recognition that, and what I read that is, it would be a change in the law. So it would be applying a new interpretation of the Constitution. And I'd argue that, and I'd point out that when we look at the Fourth Amendment, we interpret it consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court. There's been no argument that Article 1, Section 11 of the Wisconsin Constitution provides any different or alternative basis. And I would say that given this Court's consistent interpretation of that section with the Fourth Amendment, there isn't a separate state constitutional ground for reading that rule into our state constitution either.
Did you agree with the state that on an affidavit for a warrant, if that evidence is later subject to a motion to suppress, that the state can only rely on information in the warrant and cannot rely on other information available but not put into the affidavit?
Yes, because that's being that information, outside information, would be being used to rehabilitate an otherwise infirm affidavit, where we're using the additional information to assess the reasonableness at the time of entry. So I think there's a different purpose, a different use for the information that's withheld from the warrant application.
Well, under the rule proposed, what do you think the result of that is?
I think logically and under present law, the reviewing court should know that the officers who executed the warrant had that information before them at the time of entry. I don't think that should be that is information that should be withheld from the reviewing court. Because I think we look at the decision makers here, and because we're deferring to the discretion of the executing officers, we need to know everything they know at the time of entry to determine whether their decision is reasonable or not reasonable. So that includes information that comes to them after the fact that may have been within their collective knowledge, but perhaps not the knowledge of the specific officer who applies for the warrant. And it may include information from other law enforcement agencies. You know, as in this case, there was the Stevens Point Police Department and the County Sheriff's Department that were both involved with the search. So it's possible that a law enforcement agency had that information. And I think if you're going to then impute that all of that information to the officer who's applying for the search warrant, you know, it risks artificially withholding from the court information that was known to the officers at the time of execution.
Oh, have you considered, for purposes of this oral argument, the question of what's wrong with the defendant's proposal? from a policy standpoint. I mean, you say there's no law to justify it and all that, but in terms of public policy, in terms of what's the best practice, is there anything wrong with her proposal?
I think it's a better practice for police to try to obtain judicial authorization for a no-knock. I do not believe it's sound public policy to impose a rule that withholds reliable and relevant information known to the executing officers merely because it was not shared with the judge at the time the warrant was sought. Because we have an interest in eliminating or reducing crime, we have an interest in a fair and just adjudication in a criminal case, and the outcome, you know, of the defense suggestion is that evidence is suppressed even when there's not, in fact, a Fourth Amendment violation.
So you think officers should be able to withhold knowledge from the issuing magistrate?
There's no incentive for them to withhold the knowledge. If they err and don't give the court enough information, you know, they're unlikely to get the authorization they need. You know, so there's no incentive for them to withhold the information. There is an incentive for them to give the court all of the information they believe is necessary to obtain the no-knock authorization.
But if the court takes the state's position, then I think if I were a law enforcement officer, I would not ask for a no-knock. That is, yeah, I would not ask for a no-knock warrant. I don't need it. All I have to do is when I arrive at the door, I have enough information, whether it's in the affidavit or not, to enter without a knock. So why would I ever look at it? I think the incentive would be don't ask. Don't ask, they won't tell you. Then you can just do as the circumstances warrant. We took the defense position, then why would I have an incentive to do a no-knock? Because if I enter if it's denied, then I need extra information. And if it's granted, I'm probably safe as long as nothing changes. So maybe I've got an incentive to ask. Because if I don't ask and don't get it and have no new information, then I don't have a warrant with a no-knock, so it's no good.
Yeah, the police would be afraid that they would be turned down.
But at least they know up front they'll be turned down, and I think that's the safer course of action than finding out at the suppression hearing that they would have been turned down and that this judge does not think that their actions are reasonable. I think that's the incentive for officers under our rule to still go ahead and seek prior judicial authorization. Then they are getting an opinion of a trial judge or magistrate that your beliefs are reasonable, we agree with you, go ahead and do this. So that when they come back at a suppression hearing, there's already been an initial review that said that their suspicion is reasonable. And so they have an incentive versus risking executing the warrant in a manner that will later be held to be unreasonable and risking perhaps suppression of the evidence. So I think, so under the current rule, there is still a great incentive.
Well, if there is such a great incentive, then what's wrong with the rule? What's wrong with having the rule that they should do it?
There's an incentive under the current system.
Right.
Under the present, under...
As you see the present system, state rule,
right.
But you don't need it.
Mm-hmm. So what's the, I'm sorry, just...
So what's wrong with the rule proposed by the defendant? If there's already an incentive and they should be doing it, why not tell them to do it? Just like we do it with search warrants. Get the search warrant. That way we'll defer.
The risk is in the remedy. And if we're going to withhold reliable information from the reviewing court merely because of an officer's unintentional failure to give them all of the information they had, then then the trial court, the reviewing court, can't accurately assess what the officers knew at the time of entry.
There's nothing here that shows, as far as I know, that they intentionally withheld. It was a matter of not disclosing. I mean, in the transcript, at least as far as I know, is that a correct reading of that?
Exactly. There's nothing that discusses why they didn't do it. This occurred about 10 months after the United States Supreme Court issued Riches versus Wisconsin. Perhaps the officers were still in the mode of making somewhat of a blanket rule argument, which is erroneous and which the, you know, the reviewing court recognizes. But, you know, they gave the court all that it thought the court needed.
But what they had here, as I understand it in the application, is just the generalized averments. And I don't think that that's controverted as to the application. I guess I'm bothered that it's not that the magistrate has to be told everything the officers know. A magistrate, I advance, should be told sufficient particular information consistent with Richards versus Wisconsin that justify dispensing with a knock and announce rule. I mean, it's not like everything. Give me the, you know, everyone tell everything. You give me your name, rank, and serial number. Richards says you need some particular stuff. We can't have all this general affirmance. So all they need to do is come up with something particular enough. It's not like they need their vast encyclopedia of knowledge. Am I correct on that, or am I incorrect on that?
That's true, and the standard isn't, the burden is not high and when on the officers, and that is to actually obtain prior judicial authorization. That's what they must do. They must give particular circumstances that justify the no-knock entry.
Why do you think there's particular circumstances, since your orange light is, and I asked Ms. Hirsch this, why are there particular circumstances in this case that justify this? And if both of you haven't dealt very much, at least in your argument, about whether you call it separate and, or independent grounds, or you call it good faith, or whatever you call it, causal. Okay. Is what you guys call it in the briefs.
As a matter, for the facts, I think there are not just general stereotypes. This is based on the observation of Detective Retzky and other police officers observing Mr. Henderson and the people with whom Mr. Henderson associated. Although they were drug dealers, perhaps, you know, Mr. Moore and Mr. Rutherford, I don't know if they were drug dealers or not. It's based on what they observed watching those individuals.
Did they think Mr. Moore was in the house at the time?
They didn't know who would be in the house at the time. And Mr. Rutherford had been in the house the evening before, and they had concerns about whether or not he carried a weapon. They knew, they testified.
Why, did they know he had used weapons in the past?
No, they didn't indicate that. They said it was a big question mark in their mind. Now, Mr. Moore, who based on their investigation, the officers testified was a known associate of Mr. Henderson, had sold the confidential informant a firearm. It wasn't a matter of, you know, someone, a friend, merely possessing one. This was an associate who had sold a weapon, so who would be a means of access for a firearm if Mr. Henderson wanted it.
Well, was he in the house?
No, he wasn't. And
did they think he was going to be in the house?
They didn't know who was going to be in the house at the time. They thought that there may be individuals from Milwaukee who were also associates of Mr. Henderson. But these aren't.
Did that make him suspicious for carrying guns?
I think so. I think with these individuals, they had. There was a suggestion that there was a gang affiliation, and I think that made them suspicious. But I think more importantly is some specific facts. They knew the layout of the apartment. The confidential informant had a diagram. The drugs were kept in the bedroom. I see that my light is on. Can I proceed? The drugs were kept in the back of the apartment in a bedroom, which was directly across from the bathroom, which had both a toilet and a sink, which would make it easy to dispose of the drugs. We're talking about, you know, street sales of marijuana and cocaine, you know, not bales of marijuana, which would be difficult to destroy, but smaller packets that would be easily flushed or disposed of.
The police had had an association with Mr. Henderson before. They'd arrested him.
Mm-hmm.
Had he ever had guns?
No.
Ever used violence, other than in abusive language, but we won't go back to the first two cases.
They had dealt with him in a variety of circumstances while on patrol duty, and I think opposing counsel asks you to draw the inference that that occurred more than 8 years ago. Based on the testimony at the preliminary hearing, Detective Retzke has only been investigating drug crimes for 1 year and has been with the Stevens Point Police Department for 8 years. So between 1 and 8 years ago, at some point, Detective Retzke had dealt with him frequently in a combative manner. Mr. Henderson had made threats against the confidential informant. So we have a man who's making threats, who's been combative towards police in the past, you know, and I think those justify a concern for the officer's safety, you know, even if we take out the known associate. I see that my time is up.
We don't want to talk about causal relation, do
you? I would love to.
Next time.
Okay.
All right. Ms. Hirsch.
Thank you. I want to go over just a couple facts. First of all, I want to read you Detective Retzke's testimony about bruisers. I know this is a minor point, but it goes to the kind of testimony. He didn't have a combative relationship with Mr. Henderson. He had a combative relationship with Mr. Henderson and his associates at Bruisers. He says, when I was on patrol, I had been to numerous fights, altercations during that time, and I've had to deal with Mr. Henderson and Mr. Rutherford in a very combative atmosphere. There's no specific information that Mr. Henderson, again, this is the kind of information in this case, nothing about Mr. Henderson specifically being combative with police officers. It was a combative atmosphere. I assume Bruisers is a bar. Justice Babbage knows.
Does that mean all bars? Justice Babbage might be familiar with that.
He may. When she just said that Mr. Henderson had made threats to a confidential informant, I think that's absolutely true. I think if you check it, untrue. If you check the facts, I think you'll find it was his gang or his associates or some unknown group of people here. Going back to the what the judge was thinking at the time he issued the search warrant and didn't give the no-knock authority, I suggest to you that the likely inference in this case is the judge knew the Richards versus Wisconsin decision. And the boilerplate language in that application was the language that the court found not to be justifiable in the Richards versus Wisconsin decision. So if we're going to draw an inference from these facts, I think we should draw an inference that the judge made an intelligent decision not to grant the no-knock authority in this case, and simply 7 or 8 months later didn't remember the specifics of that. I don't think we can draw any kind of an inference that the judge actually meant to grant a no-knock warrant on that allegation in the application.
But his written opinion says that he did issue a no-knock.
You know why it says that? Because what happens is 7 or 8 months later, the defense attorney brings a motion up for suppression in which he assumes that the no-knock authority was given. And I think that just colors it, that everybody picks it up from that point and goes from that point. But if you think back about it, you just think, how could this judge have believed 10 months after Richards that this was justification for a no-knock? I mean, the judge just had to know the law. I would hate to infer that judge didn't know that.
But he did write it. The no-knock warrant was issued based on the generalized information.
I think he took that from the defense attorney's motion later, that this was sort of sloppy procedure at the trial attorney. But you could read that any way you want. The bottom line is we all know the warrant was issued.
Is the rule that you seek consistent with this court's decision in State versus Meyer?
The rule that I seek, I don't think, is really addressed in State versus Meyer. Meyer does address the factual questions, I would say. I was going to bring up State versus Meyer and say that the court clearly held in Meyer that the police have to give you facts from which you can draw inferences and not generalizations from which you can assume facts. I don't think Meyer really goes to the first issue of the warrant. But I think it's fairly clear at this point that if you think what our, if you think our current rule is Cleveland and Williams, that the police should go to the magistrate, but they don't really have to, or if they do, they can ignore the magistrate's decision.
Is the rule that you seek consistent with Richards versus Wisconsin?
Yes, it is consistent with Richards versus Wisconsin.
And that's because you say there were exigent circumstances.
That's correct.
But what were the exigent circumstances?
There were no exigent circumstances in this case. The rule we seek is that if police believe they have justification for no-knock authority when they go to get their search warrant, they have to tell the magistrate that, and the magistrate makes a decision. If there are no new exigent circumstances, the police are bound by the magistrate's decision. And when they come back later on a suppression motion, the judge who's reviewing that decision then gives that decision deference and makes the decision based on the record that was before the magistrate. And it's the same as the warrant application. You know, Justice Babbage, I was thinking about that hypothetical. And if you take your hypothetical where the police have some information, they go to the magistrate, they say, this is the information I have, other police might have other stuff, and the magistrate says, no, you don't have probable cause, I'm not giving you a search warrant. The police officer can't go out, talk to his fellow officers, and then just decide on their own to do a probable cause search. They have to go back to the magistrate and ask at that point. And so I think that the analogy to the search warrant doesn't work so well. What the clear rule under the Constitution is if the magistrate says no, the police are bound by that. And you can't just, the police can't just over say, well, we've decided to exercise our own judgment in this case. And there's, I cannot think of a reason why those general constitutional principles don't apply to this decision as well.
Did I understand you to say that if the judge turns down a request for no permission to enter without knocking,
right,
that they cannot knock afterwards?
No, I'm sorry.
They cannot enter without...
Unless there are exigent circumstances. That they're not free to simply, Justice Abramson said if she were a police officer, she was thinking whether she'd have an incentive to go. If I were a magistrate issuing warrants, if I were a judge making warrant decisions, and the rule the state argues were the rule, I wouldn't make a decision. I would refuse to consider no-knock requests because it just allows a second judge to say that I was wrong, to completely second-guess me at a later date. There's no reason for me to spend my time making a meaningless decision. If the police are free to ignore it, a new court is free to look at it de novo, why would I bother to look at that information? My time is up.
Justice Strasser.
Any further questions?
Are the exigent circumstances that would excuse a search without a warrant same as the exigent circumstances that permit entry without knocking and announcing?
They go to different standards, probable cause to believe a crime is being committed or reasonable grounds to believe one of the no-knock things. But yes, the exigent circumstances would be the same kind of things arising at the scene, something happening right then and there, the police have to react, yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. That concludes the argument in this third case, 99-2296 CR, and concludes our sitting in Baraboo. We will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30, when we will continue our October calendar. We are in recess. And